There's a profound understanding that we slowly absorb, understand, develop over time as we practice, as we meet the truth of things. And this understanding is basically that there's nothing else in the world except relationships. And it's hard to grasp because we think we are somebody and we are a person separate, and there is relationships with the world. But actually, we ourselves are relationships. We are made by the world. The Buddha was saying, who do you think you are? You're just a bunch of porridge, a bunch of daisa, walking about on two legs. That's all you are. And I think we can, there's many ways which we can understand this, but if we just look at the content of our consciousness, the stream of consciousness, the millions of thoughts that appear, where do they come from? Did we make them? Are they really ours? Or are they voices that we've been getting all our life and are just going around and being repeating themselves? So the most intimate place, which is our own mind, is not really ours. It's the voices of the world talking through us. And wherever you look, you'll see relationships. Our senses, eyes, ears, nose. Buddhist language, they are doorways. And we can see it's obvious they are doorways. The eye receives and is connecting to the world, sees things. But we are in the world. So the doorways, in a way, the doorways of the world are when we feel shut off, but we still have doorways to look at the world and to hear the world and to touch the world. So I won't go into it now. It's a deep exploration, but very often the word emptiness is used in the Buddhist world, and I think it should be replaced by this word of the totality of relationships, which Thich Nhat Hanh described as interbeing. Everything is interbeing, is being with everything else. There isn't separation. There isn't departments and barriers and walls in reality. It's just a total relationship that's moving all the time. Why I am saying that in this particular retreat on metta, on heart energy, is that if everything is in relation to everything else, then what kind of relationship do we want? And in a very, very simple, direct place, we have two directions. We can go towards protection, separation, which has in it survival, the pressure to survive, and it has in it pain, dukkha, struggle and suffering. We can go there as our path in relationship. Me, I need what I have to have, my survival, my needs, my protection, my fears, my issues, and friction and anxiety and all of that that you know. Or we can go in another direction, in the intimacy of relationship, which is to love, to togetherness, to intimacy, and in the Buddhist language, kusala, meaning what is beneficial, helpful, and harmonious. So we have that choice all the time, going towards what's harmonious and going towards the struggle place and survival place. Because we have that choice is the reason we need to develop metta, kindness. And it's development. In other words, it asks us to go to a beneficial place, metiv, a place that's helpful, beneficial, kind, as our relationship with the world, but it needs development, it needs attention, because it doesn't come by itself. We have both all the time, but we need to favor, to prefer the kindness, then we need to do something about it. And that's why in the tradition, metta is described as metta bhavana. Bhavana is cultivation, development, to grow the metta. So, our heart, the feeling life, is always there. Our heart is constantly talking. It doesn't stop. The heart is always behind everything we know and do. The word citta, the word, traditional word, is heart-mind. In the East, they think it's a joke that the West are busy with the mind here. They say, what, the mind is here? In this object up here? In this block here? This is mind? No, the mind is here. And they really laugh at the West with the West's obsession with brain. The tradition, it's here that we know things here. The knowing is here. And the truth is, in not that I know so much about neurology and the science, but I do understand that the word affect means that every thought, if you look at the aspects in the brain to do with the language of the heart, the feeling aspect, it's behind every thought. Along with any thought, there'll be the waking up of the amygdala, the part that is feeling. There won't be a thought without feeling. And I think we can really see that if we have fine-tuning. In the meditation practice, we can see it. For example, a thought that we have a thought because we pay attention to it, because it, that's what's interesting to us. So we look at that. That's already the heart. The heart says, what do we look at? The heart says, what do I need to know? The heart says, where I need to be. The heart says, what I need to think. The heart says, what's important. Constantly. So we tend to forget it, but it's a very constant music of the heart all the time. So when we move to caring, to the heart that is caring and looking after ourselves and looking after the world, and friendliness, friendship, rather than the survival mind, the first place and the easiest place to do that is with ourselves, because we do it anyway. We are always caring for ourselves. When we eat, when we sleep, when we act, when we look after ourselves, 24 hours we're looking after ourselves. Therefore, we are our best friend. If we think about what is nearly every thought will be something about what is good for me, what is helpful, what I need to think about, which will help me. Nearly every thought. So the whole of the mind and the body and everything is busy looking after ourselves, which is not a bad thing. It means we love ourselves very, very much. And that's great. So we have it already here. We don't have to kind of invent love. It's right here. We love ourselves, and because of that, we're looking after ourselves all day, just like we are our own child, better than our own child, because we don't give, you know, our child, we give, what, kaffa now and then? At least some parents, but... no, we do that to ourselves as well. We have our own judgments and criticisms, and we give ourselves smack. But very fundamentally, we are our best friend. And we can acknowledge that, and we can develop that. And that's what we're doing in the metta practice. It starts with us because it's the easiest place. It doesn't mean it's always straightforward. We can start there and then we end up just being angry with ourselves. It's true. It doesn't mean to say it's straight road. But it's potentially the easiest place to practice metta because fundamentally, deeply, we love ourselves. And it's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. We start there. It's not narcissism. It's just very basic. To be a friend of ourselves is a good way to start the morning and to do anything in life. There's a poem that says this, that I like, old poem. One day you will, with excitement, greet yourself arriving at your own door. In your own mirror, each will smile at the other's greeting, saying, "Sit here, eat." You will love again the stranger who was yourself. You will give wine, you will give bread, you will give your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, who you ignored, perhaps, for others, but who knows you by heart. Sit, feast on your life. A poem from Derek Walcott. In authentic meditation practice, Dharma practice, there will be natural kindness. It will be there naturally. It's not that the metta, we are inventing something from zero. It has to be there already. When you pay attention, both in English and in Hebrew, when you pay attention in English, you say you give attention. It's like a gift. Your attention is a gift. You give attention to something. It's a gift. Or in Hebrew, tzumat lev. The heart is there. You give your heart, and that's attention. So it's right there. And when you're practicing, for example, with the body, intimacy is closeness. You go to the object of attention. You join the object of attention, whatever it is, the body, the breath, the birds outside. You go to. It's an act of joining. For that to happen, there needs to be some trust, some readiness to be within intimacy with ourselves or with the object of meditation. It does beautiful things, this attention. It's healing. I remember I used to go to my good friend in Klil, Israel, for exercises on the eyes. He's an expert on working with the Bates eye exercises. And now and then he just says, look, pay attention to the stress around the eyes, but know that your attention is love. And if you love the stress around your eyes, you will love your eyes. And if you love your eyes, you're healing them. And it was very sweet to that sense of attention is love and love is healing. It's warming, it's softening. So there's natural kindness in meditation already. Otherwise, meditation wouldn't work. I never forget going to Mark Williams in Oxford, professor who developed MBCT, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which is a very much science-based therapy using mindfulness. And I was sitting with him and his group there in Oxford, and I said to him, where is the love in what you're doing? And he said, without love and compassion, the whole thing doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And this is a very protocol-based, rather technical mindfulness system, which has purposes and a system and a protocol. But he said, without love and compassion inside, it doesn't work. And it's true. I know that many of you have heard this before, but I do want to say it again, that that I did meet this old monk many, many, many years ago, and we asked him about his practice. And he said, I go through my body bit by bit, and every part of my body, I ask it, are you happy? And it says, yes, I'm happy. Right ear, are you happy? Yes, I'm happy. Left ear, are you happy? Yes, I'm happy. Nose, how are you this morning? I'm happy. It's very sweet, but it does tell us something. It's actually inherent in the practice already. We do something similar. We touch places, we touch our body with our mind, we're connecting, we're intimate, we breathe, we're with the breath, where the breath is flowing, we're with it, we flow with it. In there is already the kind heart. Knowing is loving. Basically, knowing and loving are the same thing. It even says in Tanakh, that knowing and loving, same word, yeda. In the Buddhist tradition, there is a lot of depth around the side of loving. Fundamentally, deeply. The Dalai Lama, I want to quote the Dalai Lama, he said, this is my simple religion. There is no need for temples, no need for complicated philosophy. Our own mind, our own heart is our temple. Our philosophy is kindness. And if any of you have listened to Thich Nhat Hanh or read his books, every time he mentions mindfulness and meditation, it's with so much heart. His mindfulness makes trees grow, makes life shine. Like he says, every time I walk, I step on the earth, a flower blossoms underneath my feet. The whole act of mindfulness in Thich Nhat Hanh language, his language is very beautiful, is heartful, is heart. I like the word apamada. So apamada in the Pali language means caring mindfulness, caring awareness. It's really not mindfulness anymore. It's caring awareness, awareness with care, awareness with love. Translated in the English as sometimes heedfulness, meaning paying attention to what's helpful, paying attention to what's beneficial, not just paying neutral attention like being a computer. It's attention which has benefit. And that's kind of really a critical practice. just before the last words before the Buddha died, he said, all constructed things, which is relationships, by the way, everything is made of everything else. Practice apamada, seriously. Caring awareness. And insights that we have tend to be the side, have in it the side of heart. You could say that the insights we're looking for, tovanot, inside our practice, will always be tend to be holistic, will always tend to be more open, more heartful. In a tradition, an insight is something that gives birth, that is like the womb giving birth. The insight is not neutral, analytic. I had a great idea, philosophical idea. It can be there, it's not a problem, but the insights that we're talking about that are liberating insights are insights that have fruit, that give birth, that give birth to freedom, that give birth to benefit, that give birth to something that's helpful and liberating. They have a purpose, they have a direction. They're productive. And the word here, yoniso manasikara, is relevant. The Buddha said he used that kind of insight on the way to his one night of total liberation. He developed insight using yonisi manasikara, which means, which is female. It's birth. It's a female. It's the word of the female. And it means a wisdom that gives birth, a wisdom that is has fruit, that is holistic, that is whole, that is brings harmony. So you could say in the brain sense that it's using all the insights that we're interested in and that we value in the Dharma and in, I think, spiritual life altogether is using the whole being, the heart, the mind, the left brain, the right brain, the top brain, the bottom brain, the whole lot. That's the kind of insight. It's not just left brain insight, analytic, scientific. It's the whole. It's holistic. It needs the heart and the mind, all of us. I have to say that, and it's something that I think both Simi and myself mentioned already, that in the spiritual life, there is also has been a domination of patriarchy, of the male, and of the mind. And it's symbolized by the monasteries in the East where the women are at the back, secondary. And that's tradition, that's history. It's not the essence, but it's grown through time. And the Dalai Lama, both the Dalai Lama and Ajahn Amaro are both teachers that I listened to about, who talked about this. Ajahn Amaro, I met him and I talked to him, and he's perhaps the Western leader for the Theravada movement, the head of the monastery, Amaravati. And I asked him what is he doing in his monastery about the status of female nuns. And he said, I can't undo everything in a radical way. I can't destroy 2,000 years of, even if I don't like it, but I can't destroy it. But what I can do is I refuse to force anything to happen. I refuse to make sure that this is continuing, this patriarchy. I won't do anything. And if a woman wants to go first and be the first, I'm absolutely fine with that. Everyone will take their choice. I am not keeping these rules anymore. But I can't undo them aggressively. And Dalai Lama said more or less the same thing. And when the Dalai Lama was talking about it, he was crying. He said, I can't undo it. It's so heavy. It's so formal. It's so structured in the system, patriarchy. I can't undo the whole thing. But I don't like it. And both of them said that. And when I was there in Amaravati, in the monastery in England, I watched the nuns go right to the front with their bowls, in front of all the monks, in front of the young ones, in front of the old ones, and take their food first and sit in front, and everything fine, no problem. No one really. I don't know what some of the older monks might be like that, but there wasn't anything out there that was stopping it. But it's true that the heart has been left behind in the development of, I would say, religious practice, not only the East but also the West. In Jewish, Christian, Buddhist, Muslim, same. The patriarchy is so strong, the heart gets left behind, and the female gets left behind. And in the West, we have this language of mind, and mind is dominating over the heart. It's just something we should know culturally. Mindfulness, I actually don't like the word. I'd prefer mindlessness. Yeah. Less mind. Who needs this mind? Too much mind. We already have much too much. So we need mindlessness. So I use the word erut in my book. So why I'm saying all of that, and I do have a grumble. I won't go into the politics of all of that, but I do feel it strongly. But it's important to understand it from our point of view. If the culture has left the heart behind to some extent, then it's up to us to bring it up, bhavana, to develop it, to give it its place. It's, again, I just want to remind you what I said before, it's already there. It's not that it's not there. It's already there in the practice. And if we never go on a metta retreat, we will still develop metta over our practice. Gradually, it will be there. But because of the dominance of mind, and because it's a power that's really helpful to us, and because it's a liberating power. So it's helpful to specifically develop metta. And that's this retreat. It's helpful to bring up to that the heart catches up with the mind. So it's personal, it's cultural, and it makes a balance in the practice. So we give it energy. We give it activity. We learn how to develop heart energy. It's active. It's a practice. We're doing it consciously. Bhavana, development. I have a quote from Thich Nhat Hanh. He said, metta is loving kindness. And loving kindness is the capacity of offering happiness. It's a process of learning, because to make others happy, you need to be there. You need to learn how to look at ourselves, or at him, at her. You need to learn how to talk to the other. Making another person happy is an art. that we have to learn. You are there just by their side, and the other person enjoys your presence, enjoys your company, because your person contains loving kindness, radiates loving kindness. And whatever you do can bring this other person a lot of happiness. A word, a look, it's enough. So it's active, we learn the practice. If you listen to old-time teachers, been around a long time, they'll always talk in the language of the heart. The heart will be very strong in the way they are, in their language, in their its maturity. Spiritual maturity creates more heart. I remember Jack Kornfield when he was here in Israel. He was overwhelming with heart. He was, he was telling us how he went on a walk in Meir Shearim with Holocaust survivors. He just found them, or they found him. And he was, there were seven people going on a slow walk through Meir Shearim with, and he just joined them, and he, just because he, of the heart. You know. The heart language is the language of participation, of being part of. Going back to what I said about relationships, we are in total relation with the world, with ourselves, with everyone, with everything, with the air we breathe, and with the water, and with the trees, and with the life. We are in total relationship with it. So metta, the heart language, tells us that. It's a language of participation. It's a language of response to the world. It's a language of joining the world, of relating. And as I say, it has benefit. It's helpful. It brings goodness. No better way to live in this world than the practice of metta as a path to awakening, said the Buddha. So, in this retreat, we're practicing metta kind of with the practice of awareness, of presence, of vipassana, or of awareness practice. We don't need to forget the awareness practice because it rides on it. Just like Thich Nhat Hanh said, you have to see in order to be, for your heart to be active. You have to see what's needed. You have to see the other to be kind to the other. You have to notice. So tsumat lev, noticing, is part of what we're doing. So the two go together. The seeing and the heart movement go together. There will be difficulties that come up. This is the nature of being a human being. This is the nature of samsara. This is the nature of karma, conditioned life. So we will experience difficulty and hindrances that come up in this retreat and in our life. It's fair enough. But the metta gives us tools, along with the seeing, along with the awareness and the kindness adds a really powerful tool for us to work with, to meet, to allow the difficulty, and to be able to look with the difficulty with new eyes and a different heart. So metta in this retreat and in our life gives us a whole another kind of toolkit of working with difficulty. And it's very fundamental. The metta will tell us you don't need to fight demons. You can also love them. Actually, the demons are us asking for love. That's what demons are. They're asking us for love. I have in my mind this, of course, because of Khalil, the wild pigs everywhere, Khazire Bar. And just the morning before I came here on Wednesday, there was lots of them around. And when I got up, they were still there. And I went out to feed the chickens. And standing in front of me was this huge wild pig, Khazir Bar, looking at me. And I was looking at it. And it was quite close, like this distance. And I kind of was trying to understand, what is it telling me? What's it want to say? What's it trying to say? Because it didn't run away. And I felt it was thirsty. So, and I had an uncertainty. If I give water and food to the pigs, then there'll be just more of them. But I decided that on the spot, never mind all of that thinking, there'll be more of them is a thinking. Right now, it's thirsty. I'm going to make sure there's water. So I quickly filled the whole gigit with water and left it there for the pigs. But it's such a monster in a way, a wild pig looks, and it goes, you know, this sound. And I just had that thought, maybe it's asking for my love. And maybe every monster is asking for our love. And that's why it's a monster. And the tradition, of course, the mythological tradition is full of ways of working with that. If you kiss the frog, becomes a prince or princess, right? That's in the mythology. So fundamentally, metta is kindness. It's going to and noticing with the heart and offering kindness, giving happiness, giving kindness, giving goodness. It's active. It's sometimes needs an intention. It can be intuitive. It's quite important that it's not functional, that we don't have a functional attitude to metta. In other words, we don't measure how much it works. If I give 50% metta, then I want 50% back pleasure. It's like a mother that says, if I give this much milk, I want my baby to smile. If I give this much, my baby will smile more. If the baby cries, then something's wrong. I'm not going to give him milk anymore. We can't measure this. The metta is a bit like chesed or bracha, blessing. We don't expect reward from a blessing. We give a blessing for the sake of it. And it's a bit like that. It spreads goodness, but there's no way we can measure or get it back or decide how much, or it should work and it didn't work, and then I'm not doing it anymore, etc., etc. It is about a movement of the heart which just makes life different. What actually happens in life is not in our hands. But metta, that's why when we say the phrases, for example, we trigger a different heart energy. That's all. The heart is different. The heart has a different language. And what happens then is not in our hands. The phrases that you heard today, we can regard them as triggers. They can be really, really helpful, especially when we lost the practice or we feel tight, hard, restricted, contracted, where our heart feels dried, where we feel lost. The phrases give power because they're language. So we can use the phrases wisely to trigger the heart, to lift up the energy of the kindness in the heart. And I say this almost every retreat, but so those of you who've been on many retreats, metta retreats, will also know these stories, but I'll say it again anyway, just because it's relevant. The first time that I went on a metta retreat was at least 20 years ago. I don't know more than that. It was with Sharon Salzberg, and in Switzerland. And I found the phrases too long for me personally. So I just put all the phrases into one little two words. Be happy. That's it for me. But I did say them. And I say them again millions of times, actually. It was the first retreat and I really got into it. So I say it again and again. But I was walking all day in the forest in Switzerland. And every single thing that happened, I would relate, be happy, be happy. A leaf fell from a tree, be happy. Another leaf, be happy. Another leaf, be happy. A grass went like that, be happy. An insect came, be happy. A dog came, be happy. A clouds in the sky, be happy. But I'm just saying it because it triggers the heart. It makes something happen. It's active. And metta bhavana is active. It's not that you need the phrases all the time. We work with them wisely, but there is a place for them. And sometimes there's a place for a more silent, just radiating kindness, spreading kindness to ourselves, to wherever the object is. We start with the self because it's close. We may have reactions and responses that are not so sweet. It's quite possible. We may tell ourselves to love and we get back, what the hell are you talking about? I want my anger. I need my anger. All sorts of things can happen. The heart is not in our hands, not in our control. But we can slowly move the heart in that direction. And if the heart does respond with other things, anger, resistance, all kinds, frustration, it can trigger memories, it can trigger all sorts of things. It's okay, the whole of us is moving towards the practice of kindness. And on the way, there can be many ups and downs. Kind of a lunar park of the heart. But that's okay. That's okay. Let it happen. And just trust, as we practice, the heart is directed towards more kindness, more ease, more happiness, more giving to the world, more harmony. Slowly, slowly, it's a direction. Thank you. So we'll take a few minutes quiet.